Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Cow-calf producers, obviously these markets are essentially at record levels. I don't expect that to change very much. So cow-calf producers, if you got calves to sell, you're going to do pretty well. There are things you can do to add even additional value to that. So it's not too early to start thinking about preconditioning programs and weaning programs. Those do add additional value, and they do work even in high prices. So producers might want to start thinking about that.
That's Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Daryl Peel on where the industry is now.
But all in all, we're just kind of enjoying these markets right now from a cow-calf standpoint. Stocker producers, it's a little more challenging given the margin situation between calf prices and feeder cattle prices. But again, there's opportunities for everybody in this market.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The U.S. has finalized new trade agreements with Japan, Indonesia, and the Philippines that promise to expand access for American ag. In the Japanese deal, President Trump secured a 15% reciprocal tariff rate and a $550 billion Japanese investment. Now for ag producers, the most notable gain, Japan's pledge to increase purchases of U.S. rice within its existing WTO quota and expand access for beef, pork, and grains. The agreement avoids previously threatened 25% tariffs on autos and goods. Indonesia will eliminate tariffs on 99% of U.S. farm and industrial goods. That includes soybeans, cotton, wheat, and soybean meal. Indonesia also dropping non-tariff barriers that restricted U.S. ag products. Philippines dropping tariffs on several U.S. ag exports, including soy, wheat, animal feed, and dairy. Deal expected to reduce input costs for Philippine livestock producers. However, concerns have been raised that duty-free imports may undercut local farmers. Altogether, the agreements could help boost U.S. ag exports across Asia while securing friendlier trade terms for a range of commodities. Well, the House Ag Committee has approved H.R. 4550. It's the U.S. Grain Standards Reauthorization Act of 2025. That bipartisan measure now moves to the full House for consideration. Grain standards essential for maintaining the integrity of U.S. grain exports. Legislation extends USDA's authority over grading and inspection of grains like corn, wheat, and soybeans. Standards relied on by domestic buyers and international trading partners alike. The bill also ensures continued access to reliable, transparent, and consistent quality benchmarks for grain markets. Reauthorization is typically done every 5 years. Without it, USDA's ability to oversee official grain inspections would expire later this year. U.S. beef exports in May totaling 229 million pounds, down 11% from a year ago. That's according to USDA's Livestock, Dairy, and Poultry Outlook. The decline is largely due to reduced shipments to China, which imported only 4 million pounds, the lowest volume since 2020. Now, that drop tied to the expiration of Phase 1 trade deal export registrations for several U.S. beef plants in March, and as a result, year-to-date exports to China through May down 33%. But despite this, exports to major Asian markets remain strong. May shipments to South Korea surged 39% from last year. Japan up 3%. Exports to Hong Kong up 28%. Total exports through May reaching nearly 1.18 billion pounds, about 6% below the same period in 2024. USDA raising its second quarter beef export forecast by 10 million pounds to 700 million, bumping up the third quarter to 660 million. Full year exports now projected 2.728 billion pounds, but still 9% below last year. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Terry Abbott. As I serve as chairman of the Council of Producers and Distributors of Agrotechnology and as senior product portfolio manager at Adjuvants Unlimited based in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Abbott testifying at a House Ag Committee hearing on Tuesday on past breakthroughs and future innovations in crop production.
CPDA represents the formulators, distributors, manufacturers, and suppliers of adjuvants, inert ingredients, and post-patent pesticide products, representing nearly 90% of the U.S. crop protection market. Our members drive innovation across formulation, stewardship, and field performance. When we talk about innovation in agriculture, it starts with access to tools. Farmers need affordable, reliable options to manage pests, protect yields, and keep their operations productive. That includes maintaining a competitive market for post-patent crop protection products and ensuring a regulatory system that delivers timely, science-based decisions. Our industry also drives innovation beyond active ingredient. Companies like mine are advancing adjuvant and inert technologies that improve how products perform in the field. These tools reduce drift, enhance coverage, and support compliance with environmental requirements, including the Endangered Species Act. They are essential for precision, stewardship, and modern production. To keep these tools available, we need a regulatory system that works. Right now, over $500 million in CPDA member products are stuck in the EPA's regulatory backlog. In turn, CPDA strongly supports full funding for EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs, and we encourage continued improvements under PREA to strengthen transparency and predictability in the registration process. A well-functioning OPP benefits farmers, innovators, consumers, and the environment, ensuring access to safe, effective, and trusted crop protection tools. We appreciate the Farm Program improvements in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, but we also support a Farm Bill 2.0 that builds on this momentum and reflects the needs of today's agriculture. Last year's Farm, Food, and National Security Act includes provisions we view as important. We support language directing NRCS to update conservation practice standards so that programs recognize current technologies. We also support expanding access to technical service providers to ensure farmers have expert guidance when implementing conservation plans. We are encouraged by the proposed Centers of Excellence for Crop Protection Products and Application Technology. These centers would support research and innovation in formulation and delivery, helping ensure the United States remains a global leader in crop protection, environmental stewardship, and ag innovation. Lastly, I want to emphasize the critical role crop protection technologies play in maintaining a safe, affordable, and abundant food supply. These tools undergo rigorous review and are used responsibly by farmers every day. As the MAHA Commission continues its work, we urge policymakers to recognize the science, the safety record, and the value of these technologies in supporting both production and public confidence.
Austin Scott is a representative from Georgia.
Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I look forward to continuing the discussion. I do think hopefully we'll see bipartisan efforts to solve these problems.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Basically, we've got farm policy in place through 2031.
Washburn University tax law specialist Roger McCohen.
When you look at this, what they've done, if we go through this kind of sequentially, this is subtitle C. Well, it's actually the commodity subtitle of the bill, which is in Title One, and then you get into the various subtitles of that. They've got the nutrition subtitle that's in there, but if we look at commodities in subtitle C, the reference prices for the major crops, the covered crops, have gone up significantly, and that's important because the payments, government payments, whether it's ARC or PLC, those payments are based on an effective reference price, which is based on a formula. And under the revised formula, the minimum price is set at 88% of the Olympic average price for the previous 5 years, and the maximum price can't exceed 113% of the statutory reference price. Now, that's higher than where we had been. And then the reference prices for the major commodities has been raised 11 to 21% across the board. Some are lower, others are higher, but they're all between 11 and 21% higher. So what that does is it increases the floor. So if the market price for commodities drops and it hits that floor, then you're going to get a payment. So they've raised the floor, which means they've increased the safety net. The reference price for corn is 410, wheat 635, soybeans is 10, and those are going to be the big ones in Kansas. And there's an annual escalator of 0.5% starting with the 2031 crop year, and that is capped at 113% of the new baseline, which is that original statutory reference price. And a couple other big ones with respect to that is that this year producers are going to get the higher of their ARC or PLC, no matter how they're signed up. They can get the higher of the two, and then starting next year with ARC, if they're getting ARC ag risk coverage, if that's the way they're getting their payments, they can also get supplemental coverage option, which is a boost on crop insurance, which previously they'd not been eligible to do that. That if you're getting payments by ARC, you weren't eligible for SCO, and that starts next year. So really big stuff with respect to reference prices.
He also talks about a change in payment limits.
Historically, any time that the farming operation is structured in any type of structure that limits liability, then you're only entitled to one payment limit. Now, the general payment limit has been $125,000 per person. So if I have an entity that limits liability, I get one person determination. So if you and I are in, for example, a C corporation together and we qualify for $125,000 of ARC or PLC payments, we split those. If we're 50-50 owners, we're going to split that $125,000 between us. We don't get two payment limits in that situation. That's changed under this legislation because they create something known as a qualified pass-through entity. So there's been a number of us, and I've been one included, that's been pushing for this for quite some time, that we need to make the payment limitation rules match the tax rules. So if we have a pass-through entity, that should be treated like a pass-through entity for payment limitation purposes, meaning there should not be any one-person payment limit put in place just simply because you've got an S corporation that limits liability but passes the income through to the individual shareholder, or you've got an LLC that's treated tax-wise as a partnership, for instance. When I first started out practicing, one of the things that I was involved with was structuring farming operations to maximize farm program payments and working around that limitation. Well, that limitation's gone now, finally. And that's going to simplify things from an estate planning standpoint. That makes things easier, and it lines things up with the way we do, the way these entities are treated from a tax standpoint. So that is big. That's very, very, that's a big development.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We are meeting today to consider H.R. 4550, the United States Grain Standards Reauthorization Act of 2025.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson, as members of the House Ag Committee, gathered Tuesday to reauthorize the Grain Standards Act.
This essential law has shaped the U.S. grain and oilseed industry for more than a century. Originally enacted in 1916, the United States Grain Standards Act provides the federal government with the authority to establish official marketing standards for grains and oilseeds, along with procedures for inspection and weighing. These standards are a cornerstone of our agricultural system, supporting transparency, consistency, and fairness across the supply chain. They help ensure that U.S. grain maintains its strong reputation for quality and reliability in global markets. Producers, processors, exporters, and buyers all rely on the integrity and accuracy of the official grain inspection and weighing services. These services not only help farmers receive a premium for their crops, but also give buyers the certainty they're receiving the quality they've come to expect. While many of these provisions of the Act are permanently authorized, a few key authorities are set to expire this September. A lapse in authorization could create significant disruption and inspection and weighing processes, leading to uncertainty in both domestic and international markets. U.S. competitiveness in global markets depends on uninterrupted, consistent, and cost-effective inspection services. The updated provisions before us today reflect thoughtful input from stakeholders and aim to ensure continuity and create more opportunity to advance grain grading technology. This legislation reflects a strong bipartisan consensus. I want to thank Subcommittee Chairman Scott and Ranking Member Davis for holding a hearing on this important issue and helping educate members on the value of official marketing standards. I also appreciate the partnership of Ranking Member Craig of the full committee in working collaboratively to move this effort ahead.
Chairman of the committee, G.T. Thompson, the ranking member from Minnesota, Angie Craig.
U.S. grain standards are a key component of foreign trade and promoting American agriculture exports. The inspections and certifications done by the Federal Grain Inspection Service, states, and private agencies provide foreign importers with certainty regarding the quality of the grain bought from U.S. farmers. With parts of the existing U.S. Grain Standards Act set to expire on September 30th, 2025, we should avoid adding additional uncertainty to farmers' lives by reauthorizing and improving this law. The bill before us reauthorizes annual appropriations for standard development and maintenance. USDA's authority to collect fees for supervision of inspections and weighing, an administrative supervisory cost cap, and the Grain Inspection Advisory Committee, all important components of the existing law. However, the bill also makes some key improvements. The legislation steers USDA to prioritize the modernization of grain grading technologies. The U.S. grain inspection system is known around the world for quality and reliability. Yet, as new technologies and new tests with improved speed, accuracy, and consistency come into play, other countries may try to leap ahead of our high standards. We cannot rest on our laurels. By focusing USDA's attention on modernization, we can continue to hold our place as the world's gold standard in grain inspection.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss innovations in crop production, including biostimulants.
At a House Ag Committee hearing on Tuesday, looking at past breakthroughs and future innovations in crop protection.
My name is Carl Wyant, and I serve as the Director of Agronomy at Nutrien. I'm also a certified crop advisor and certified professional agronomist through the American Society of Agronomy, where I advise growers on their inputs and help solve problems during the growing season. Nutrien is the world's largest provider of crop inputs, including fertilizers and agronomic services, supporting hundreds of thousands of grower customers across the United States and globally. We serve 45 states through our extensive retail network, where we provide seed, crop protection tools, fertilizer, and agronomic services, supporting both conventional and organic farmers of many crops and farm sizes. We are proud to be a leader in agricultural innovation, including plant biostimulant products. Plant biostimulants are a class of crop inputs that includes diverse substances such as humic acids, seaweed extracts, beneficial microbes, and protein hydrolysates, among others. These work differently than fertilizers or pesticides, which add nutrients directly to the plant or soil, or protect the plant from pests and diseases. Biostimulants work by enhancing the plant or soil's natural processes, in essence, triggering the plant's own systems to boost nutrient release and uptake, improving stress tolerance to heat and cold, and supporting overall plant and soil health. For example, Nutrien's reactive carbon technology platform was shown in a study to improve yields in wine grapes by 13% over a control plot. This product works by stimulating microbial growth in the soil, which improves soil conditions and root growth, and therefore improves the ability of the plant to access water from the soil. This study took place in drought-prone California, highlighting the usefulness of biostimulants in a fertilizer program to improve grower outcomes. Biostimulants can also improve environmental outcomes, such as reducing nutrient loss, improving fertilizer use efficiency, and supporting plant resilience to extreme weather events. Unfortunately, plant biostimulants face an uncertain and inconsistent regulatory framework. There is currently no federal definition for plant biostimulants, leaving a state patchwork of regulations leading to inconsistent labeling and marketing claims, which could ultimately impact growers. Additionally, incorrectly treating biostimulants as pesticides delays innovation, and denies useful tools for farmers. That is why we are urging support for the bipartisan Plant Biostimulant Act of 2025. This bill establishes a science-based federal definition of plant biostimulant aligned with international plant nutrition standards already recognized in the EU, Canada, and other major agricultural economies. The bill will provide regulatory clarity and consistency across all 50 states, ensure biostimulants are recognized as a distinct input category, and avoid misclassification under FIFRA, improve the integrity of product registration, and keep U.S. growers competitive with China, Brazil, and the EU. I strongly urge the committee to support the Plant Biostimulant Act and its inclusion in the upcoming Farm Bill so our farmers have the tools they need to meet the challenges of the future.
Georgia Representative Austin Scott.
And what additional support or policy initiatives might strengthen these collaborations to benefit both the innovation and the extension that's necessary for farmer adoption?
A question most members are asking the industry. And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A lot of people are kind of pointing to kind of greater uncertainty in the political realm that's kind of being translated to kind of increase in spending.
Elliot Dennis, University of Nebraska Lincoln Livestock Economist on Consumers and the Big Beautiful Bill.
A lot of people are trying to sort that out. I kind of, if you're interested in what the effect are for agriculture, in particular livestock, the Center for Ag Profitability released a report that kind of kind of outlines those. And for livestock, it's pretty vanilla as far as kind of the impacts on it. One highlight is definitely the changes in LIP kind of premium rates. And so we kind of highlight what those are and just encourage people who want kind of a breakdown that's really kind of a snapshot of what the Big Beautiful Bill means for livestock to kind of reference there.
But for the beef industry, one of the major concerns remains New World screwworm.
Secretary Rollins has been really on top of this and, you know, really trying to make sure that we're being dynamic in our response. Really, the biggest thing was that there was a new outbreak on July 7th, you know, about 370 miles from the U.S. border, which really kind of prompted, you know, shutdowns across all of these kind of the borders, border crossings. And so that's going to have a continued impact upon feeder cattle coming into feedlots. And really the worry there is, you know, what and if it gets in, how that's going to affect the feeder cattle supply. Still a lot of uncertainty. A lot of, you know, talk has been made about facilities and building and, you know, dropping sterile male flies, but these are month efforts. And we're talking that it moved almost 300 miles in less than, you know, about two months. So we kind of extrapolate that out. You know, we're talking about a potential animal health impact on the industry by the end of the year.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Daryl Peel.
USDA had announced a plan to slowly reopen the border port, starting in the west side of the country and working their way east. 2 days after after that was supposed to begin, another detection of New World screwworm was found substantially farther north in Mexico, much closer to the U.S. border. So they closed the border again and will stay closed now for the foreseeable future. At some point in time, once we can demonstrate that we've got some control on this thing, they'll probably continue that process of reopening the border. But that might take several months now, given the proximity of the New World screwworm to the border and the threat that poses.
On beef demand.
Typically, beef demand weakens just a little bit between 4th of July and Labor Day, kind of the summer doldrums. It gets really hot, and so we don't have any holidays in that period. So it's not uncommon to see beef demand weaken a little bit. But same story there. Supplies are tighter. Beef production has been falling now through the second quarter and continues to. So we've got that balance between seasonal pressure and tighter supplies. Box beef prices actually have dropped quite a bit since the 4th of July, but that's a seasonal move for the most part. I don't look for them to go a lot farther, so I think it'll be kind of the same story there. We'll probably kind of mark time here through the heat of the summer until we get closer to Labor Day, and then we'll pick back up again.
Is the herd rebuilding?
We really don't have any real evidence yet that it's happening. Anecdotally, I think it's probably happening. We're waiting for some data. We will, at the end of July, be getting two reports that may help. One will be the monthly cattle on feed report, but that will include quarterly breakdowns of steers and heifers on feed. So we'll see what that shows about the number of heifers in feedlots. We will also get a mid-year cattle inventory report, which will give us a direct inventory estimate of cows and heifers and so on. Unfortunately, we didn't get that report last year, so it's going to be a little difficult to interpret what it means, but it will be information. We'll make the best use of it that we can to try to get a sense of whether or not we can actually verify that heifer retention is beginning to happen.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
They are. They're just finding different ways to do it or stretch it or have smaller, you know, portions, all those kind of adjustments.
Kansas State livestock economist Glenn Tonser on beef demand.
They're more likely to be doing it at home. So one of the things I didn't put in my notes here, but I'll just remember to call out to the June report, is, you know, we're seeing meals at home relative to away from home grow. You need to watch the lunch meal in particular for that, the dinner meal for that. The lunch one, people decide whether or not they're going to take leftovers to work, or, you know, some people that work from home, obviously they're going to eat at home because they're working. They're synonymous for lunch meal. But, you know, deciding the source, which is what we're talking about here, is the source of the protein for those meals. One of the key things we see people do when they're worried about their finances is go to restaurants less. And I'm interjecting that because that is not a meat comment. It has implications for meat, but it's a broader one about, like, starting with the household budget is how do we optimize that? And if I can clean the dishes and food, you know, do the food prep myself, I can stretch my dollar a little further. And that's what I think we see more and more households doing.